Welcome to Through the Ringer. I'm your host, Tate Frazier, and we are back and we are talking NFL draft. And to break it all down, we have the legend himself, John Jastrzemski, JJ Bombs. JJ, good to see you, man.
Tate, what a crazy night. I knew it would be a bomb burner across the board. My head is spinning. Draft picks are being made. The Knicks are going. Everybody's shaking here in the big city. So life is good. How are you? Let's do this.
We got to talk about it all. There's a lot to get to. It was very chalk at the top of this draft. It was kind of as expected. Going into the draft, there's a lot of conversation about who would trade up. And it turns out the top three picks, they said, we want our franchise quarterback. We want to look at the future. We'll look at the first guy, the number one pick, Caleb Williams, because you don't only get Caleb Williams in Chicago. You get Rome Odunze. Let's talk about that combination there. Two top 10 picks going to Chicago to add some firepower to an offense that already has some firepower with two great receivers.
I think they knocked it out of the park. And look, Chicago, it made all the sense in the world, despite what Justin Fields did over the final couple of games, to say sayonara, to go and reset your salary cap with a quarterback that people are saying, Tate, is generational. And we saw Caleb Williams do some monster things at USC. Now he gets the chance to go and be the savior in Chicago. Remember, the Bears are not exactly a franchise historically known for their offense and known for quarterback play. Well, Caleb Williams, the hope is when he's all said and done, he's going to be the best quarterback to ever put on a Chicago Bear uniform. And yeah, to go and get your quarterback and get Odunze and put him alongside DJ Moore, holy smokes, you're cooking with gas. And the Bears over the last 2 years have really positioned themselves beautifully to make that rise. Now, the players got to pan out. Obviously, Caleb Williams has to live up to expectations, but I don't think you could have drew it up any better.
Yeah, and maybe third time's the charm, right? We saw it with Mitch Trubisky. They take a big swing, and then they get Justin Fields. They take another swing. Those are 0-for-2, and maybe the third one with Caleb Williams. I mean, he is the number one pick, so something to keep an eye on. We have five quarterbacks taken in the top 10, JJ. We can get into all five, but I want to talk about number three because I was with our boss, Bill Simmons, the New England Patriots. They had the number three pick. There was some talk about them maybe trading back. Bill says, we want Drake May. New England Patriots say, we take Drake May. What are your thoughts about Drake going to New England and what that looks like for him in his first year going number three?
So listen, I think if you're a Patriot fan, you're thrilled. It would have been lunacy for New England where they're at as a franchise to basically say, we're not taking a quarterback. You got the third pick in the draft. There are three top quarterbacks on the board. You know they're going 1, 2, and 3. You got to come away with one of those dudes. So I thought it was total nonsense, the idea that New England was going to trade this pick. I could understand why Mr. Simmons was very on edge these last few days about what his franchise might do. But, you know, all in all, Tate, listen, I think if you're Drake May, it's not a great situation at the moment. They're trying to figure out their offensive line. They don't have great skill position players. And I know normally we're always of the mindset, hey, we want to see these kids play. We want to accelerate the learning curve as fast as we can. I think the best thing New England can do, let Jacoby Brissett play the first half of the year. Let Drake May get acclimated to the speed of the NFL game. See what's going on. Maybe get him in there by November or December. Hey, maybe you sit him a full year. But I do think he has the tools, the skill set, the sort of body you're looking for in the NFL. But I think he needs a little harnessing. I think that harnessing is a must for New England.
Yeah, I like putting him out for a year and letting him get like a red shirt year in the NFL, get his feet underneath him and get some talent around him. So I think that's a great call. The most shocking, probably, I mean, I don't even think it's a probably, Michael Penix there at number 8. A lot of people thought that he was jumping up draft boards, but maybe not this high. And to go to a team that just signed Kirk Cousins, what were your thoughts when you saw Penix go to number 8 to Atlanta?
Oh, I was stunned. I couldn't believe it. You know, the problem with buddies who watch the draft and follow along on Twitter is they get the notification before I do. So, you know, I'm watching a Knick game, I'm watching the draft, and I see a couple of picks that text in my phone that said that Penix went to the Falcons. And I'm like, am I reading this right? Am I losing my mind here? Because it makes absolutely no sense, Tate. You just paid Kirk Cousins a gazillion dollars in the offseason. Michael Penix is not 19 years old. Michael Penix is an older quarterback. The idea with him, despite the injury history, and I'm a Penix guy, I wanted to see the Giants maybe trade up back into the first round to go and get him. I thought he'd be a good fit in Vegas. I thought he'd be a good fit in Denver. So I had Penix going in the first round. So I cashed on that draft prop. Thank you, FanDuel Sportsbook. But to go to Atlanta, when Atlanta has other needs that they could put alongside a veteran quarterback, bizarre to say the least. Couldn't believe it.
Yeah, I mean, it was very bizarre, but it could be one of those things where they know something about Kirk Cousins' timeline and or maybe the medical. I don't know, but they're going to have to pay him a lot of money. So there's a lot to speculate there with Atlanta, but they do take a quarterback that showed a lot last year and obviously, you know, played a lot of college football both at Indiana and at Washington. Let's talk about a guy who just won a national championship because the Vikings get him at number 10. They trade up J.J. McCarthy. He seemed like a guy very happy and very keen on getting to Minnesota, probably going into the best situation, right, of all these quarterbacks in the top 10.
Well, you nailed it. He's got an offensive coach in Kevin O'Connell. He's got one of the three best receivers, if not the best receiver in the NFL, in Justin Jefferson. You had Addison, who really came on the scene in the second half of the year. I've never been the biggest J.J. McCarthy guy, to be perfectly honest with you, Tate. I looked at him as a guy who was kind of a byproduct of the situation he was at Michigan, where they had this ferocious offensive line. They had this great running game. I understand why a lot of the tools, you know, that the evaluators are looking for are oozing out of McCarthy, but in game action, I never looked at him. And I know there's a lot of chatter about the Giants and the potential of the Giants taking McCarthy at six. I didn't see it. I didn't look at McCarthy and say, wow, he's a top 10 pick. I think he's in a good situation. I think he's going to a place where you have an offensive-minded head coach who's gotten the most out of plenty of quarterbacks the last few years, so that's advantageous. But as far as me being a J.J. McCarthy guy, no, I don't see top 10 NFL quarterback. I could be wrong. He proved me wrong. But from watching him in college, didn't see it.
Yeah, let's talk about that number six pick because that's when the question started to come in. What were the Giants going to do? It kind of was chalk up to number five. The expectation was all there. Joe Alt, a lot of people knew Harbaugh liked him a lot, so he goes there at number five. With the Giants, Malik Nabers, the LSU tight or wide receiver that has been a top target there, and we've seen a lot of success out of guys from Baton Rouge. What were your thoughts when Malik Nabers came up? And Bill Simmons said he had the it factor, so that's good news for New York in that market.
Oh, I love Nabers. Absolutely love Nabers. He was a showman at LSU. LSU clearly has a pedigree, Tate, for churning out NFL wide receivers. We've seen plenty of them. We had one in New York City. The last time the Giants had a 1,000-yard receiver, guy by the name of Odell Beckham Jr. out of LSU. I think that's what the Giants are looking for here. And I think they really were enamored with Drake May. I think they tried their darndest to move up to three to go and get Drake May. Wasn't in the cards. New England wasn't trading the pick. They weren't going to reach on McCarthy. I think they liked Penix, but I think they wanted to trade back up to go and get Penix. So they're going to take a number one receiver, which is something they've been lacking now for a long, long time. Nabers has the it factor. I think he's going to be a star in New York.
Yeah, good news for Danny Dimes and the New York Giants and Brian Daboll, who Malik Nabers, by all accounts, is a hard worker. And Brian Daboll, he loves guys like that. So I think it's a good marriage there between those two. Let's talk about the Jets, because Brock Bowers was still on the board. They decided to go for an offensive tackle instead. What were your thoughts on the Jets and their pick?
So I totally understand it. Look, I projected Bowers to be the pick, Tate. I thought he'd fit perfectly in the slot alongside Garrett Wilson and alongside Mike Williams. But the Jets have a zillion old dudes on that offensive line. And they had plenty of players on the offensive line where there are questions about durability. Tyron Smith's terrific. How many games is Tyron Smith playing? Morgan Moses, terrific. How many games is Morgan Moses playing? Vera Tucker, terrific player. He never plays. So you have an opportunity to go and get somebody that could start for you immediately. He can be the heir apparent to Tyron Smith on the left side. Comes out of a good program out of Penn State. I got no problem when you have a 40-year-old quarterback adding to your offensive line. Now, the Jets can't whiff like they did with Mekhi Becton a few years ago, but in theory, makes perfect sense. Totally understand what they're doing.
Yeah, and shout out to his mom. If you didn't see the video, she did a great job boxing out his girlfriend from the footage. So, you know, he knows how to block. His mom knows how to block. He's got it in his genes, so that's good news. Last thing, JJ on the draft. Bo Nix, another name that came in. But did you have a favorite first-round pick? Was it Bo Nix in that Sean Payton marriage with Denver? Or is there someone else that stood out to you that said what you thought was your favorite or the one that stuck out the most?
Oh, that's a really, really good question. I love Michael Penix. I hate the fit in Atlanta. I'm going to say Adunze. going to the Bears. Because you know what it is, Tate? I love the idea of drafting a quarterback and having that rookie receiver paired alongside of him where it's like, wow, they grow all
right,
together. Boys,
right.
Gain that chemistry, gain that rapport. Let's see what you're going to do. And I didn't know if Chicago was necessarily going to go in that direction, but I love the Dunze at Washington. He's a big-time playmaker. There were three outstanding receivers in this draft. Listen, I don't think you could go wrong with any of these three guys. Harrison, to me, was the best in college. Neighbors is the flashiest. A Dunze, very workmanlike. But I'll say for the Bears to get a Dunze, my favorite pick.
Yeah, and those guys, Caleb Williams and Adunze, were on the same flight out there to Detroit together from Los Angeles. So they already got to know each other, so that's good news. JJ, you're the best. We'll have you right back on the other side of this. We're going to talk about the Knicks and the Sixers. And if you're tuning in, stay tuned in because we'll be right back after this break. Welcome back to Through the Ringer. I'm here, Tate Frazier, with John Jastrzemski, and we are talking NBA playoffs, more specifically the New York Knickerbockers, who have kind of taken America by storm. A lot of people in my life have reached out about how much they love the New York Knicks, the Villanova Knicks, as I like to call them. They go to Philadelphia, and Embiid drops a 50-burger on them, and now we got a series 2-1, and we got some competition. JJ, what are your thoughts after this Game 3 and what we saw in Philadelphia?
It's a disappointing Game 3 loss. You know, you dream of Big Tate when they're up at halftime. And one of the main storylines going into Game 3 was how Jalen Brunson was going to bounce back. He did not play particularly well in Game 1 and Game 2. Well, the Knicks got the bounce back game out of Jalen Brunson. I would have signed for that stat line in a nanosecond. The problem you ran into is that Joel Embiid was that much better. And Embiid, maybe lucky, was able to stay in the game after the flagrant foul. Could have had a second flagrant foul in the first quarter. But listen, I don't want him thrown out of the game. That's lame. I'm not making excuses. The Knicks got their butts whooped in the third quarter. And that third quarter ended up being the difference in the game. I mean, Philadelphia hit three after three after three after three. I felt like I was watching the Miami Heat last night against the Boston Celtics. Tyrese Maxey really came on strong. Lowry chipped in. They got good contributions from Payne. Role players always going to play better, Tate, on their home floor as opposed to playing on the road. So I'm not stunned Philly won this game. And listen, how the Knicks respond in Game 4 is going to be a key. And you know what else is going to be a key? The status and the health of Mitchell Robinson, who left this game because he's done such a good job on Embiid. You felt it when he was not in there.
Yeah, let's talk about that matchup. I mean, that has been a battle of the bigs, and it has been a bruiser battle between those two guys. And we had like a dirty play, quote-unquote, incident there between Embiid and Mitchell Robinson. I mean, there's no love lost there. I mean, that significantly, like you said, can change the series if we don't have Mitchell Robinson on the court, right, from the Knicks side of things.
Oh, 100%. It's a game changer. First of all, look at what Mitchell Robinson did defensively a year ago to Cleveland. When you had Jared Allen, you had Evan Mobley, those guys were completely neutralized and they were embarrassed, quite frankly, in the Knicks round one victory a year ago. You look at Robinson, fourth quarter, game one, completely locked down and shut down Embiid, and his presence, Tate, it gives Hartenstein a blow. Hartenstein's played really well for the Knicks, but you saw him get into foul trouble today, played maybe more minutes than he should have, and then you got to go to the likes of Precious Achiuwa, and I'm sorry, no knock on Achiuwa, he can't hang with Embiid. So if I'm the Knicks, I don't know how I handle game four, but they better hope at some point they're going to have Robinson back in this series, because otherwise Embiid is going to continue to feast.
Yeah, and Embiid is his own sort of, I mean, there's not really anyone in the league that can handle Joel Embiid when he is healthy and he is in form. I mean, he is so huge. He is so big. He is such a force. He has had this weird thing with his left eye and the blinking. I mean, are you buying into any of this sort of speculation? Because now we got doctors talking about there's some sort of issue there, but he still had 50 points in this game, JJ. So even if he isn't 100%, he's still playing basketball at a very high level.
Tate, I learned a long, long time ago, if you're out there playing, I don't want to hear about excuses, right?
Right.
Like, that's if you're that hurt, don't play. That's it. So Joel Embiid, I understand what he went through a couple weeks ago. He's back. He can contribute. He scored 50 points tonight against the New York Knicks. you're playing. Now, I don't know how he's going to hold up for the remainder of this series. That's, to me, a great unknown. You're seeing him as 5.5-point favorites in game four, which I think makes sense. For what it's worth, I think that number's too high. If Robinson plays, now, that's a big if. If I find out Robinson's playing on Sunday, I will be on the Knicks plus 5.5. And for what it's worth, Tate, I did not like the Knicks tonight. I will never bet against them. But I did not bet the Knicks. I thought Philly was the right side tonight. I did.
You talked about Jalen Brunson a little bit and his struggles in the first two games. He had a big three late that led to that comeback. It was kind of Kawhi-esque where he hits the front of the rim and bounces in. 39 points, 13 assists in this game. Do we think that that shot maybe turned the corner with Jalen Brunson in this series where now we're seeing the regular season MVP caliber, first team All-NBA version of Jalen Brunson?
Yeah, it might have. But I kind of got the feeling, Tate, we were going to see that guy anyway. You know, a lot of people were talking about Philly's defense. Oh, it's so physical. It's so good. Listen, they have some physical guys. They have some good defenders. I thought Jalen Brunson was missing, quite frankly, a lot of shots that he was hitting in the regular season. And you saw that market correction in game three tonight. Jalen Brunson's a terrific player. He's played great in the playoffs the last 2 years. Did it for Dallas 2 years ago and outplaying Mitchell. Last year, even though the Knicks lost that series in six in the second round, he was the best player in the series against the Miami Heat. He really was. If you look statistically, that is fact, not opinion. Mm-hmm. So I expect Jalen Brunson to play well. He's a dude. He's been one of the 15 to 10 best players in the NBA this season. He's going to play well the rest of this series.
One last thing on the Knicks. Tom Thibodeau, they did this athletic report where they talked about, you know, all the players don't want to play for Tibbs, but Tibbs gets them back into the playoffs and he makes the New York Knicks relevant. As someone who was covering the Knicks, like, what is the vibe? What are the thoughts on Tibbs from inside the house, you know, after you see something like that? Because it feels like these players love playing for Tibbs, just from my vantage point.
The players love Tibbs. The fan base loves Tibbs. The city loves Tibbs. Mm-hmm. I saw that quote the other day, and I echo the sentiments, Tate, of Kendrick Perkins. You don't want to play for Tibbs? I don't want you. It's as simple as that. Right. You want a ball? Like, that's what it boils down to. Tom Thibodeau wants guys that want to play basketball. In this day and age where it's load management and it's guys not playing throughout the regular season, it is so refreshing to have a team that's full of junkyard dogs. That's what the Knicks are. They get after it every night. They compete their tails off, and they've taken on the personality of their head coach. So he can coach my team any day of the week.
Yeah. Tibbs, he's married to the game. I love watching him coach, and this is going to be a fun series. JJ, you're the best. Where can we find all your work? And then we'll let you go. Enjoy your Friday.
A whole lot of platforms. New York, New York, East Coast Bias, Ringer Gambling Show. I could go on and on, but I don't want to go too long, Tate. You got the rest of the show to do.
Yeah, hardest working man in show business. Thank you for taking the time, JJ. We appreciate you. And on the other side of the break, we're going to have Sirit Sohi join us and break down the rest of the NBA playoffs. We'll be right back after the break. Welcome back to Through the Ringer. We're still here. We just talked about the NFL draft with John Jastrzemski, and now we're going to talk NBA playoffs. And to help us break it all down, she is back on the show, Sirit Sohi. Sirit, great to see you.
Good to see you too. What's up?
Not too much. We got a lot to talk about, and I need an expert like you to help me break it down. I have been at these Clippers games, the first two games. I saw game one. I saw game two. I saw Kawhi Leonard back on the court, but I also saw Luka Doncic have a field day out there. So talking about this Clippers-Mavs series, just your impression so far after the first two games, a 1-1 even series right now. What are your thoughts on Kawhi coming back and just the overall vibes of this series?
I think Kawhi looked as good as you can look for a guy who has the injury history that Kawhi has and missed 10 straight games and was coming back into a game two that ended up being very physical. I think physicality is going to be a big story moving forward in this series. But I thought I was encouraged by a lot of different things. I think that first quarter, he was passing up a lot of different looks. He was kind of like a little bit timid. Then the second half, that was probably his best stretch. He comes out immediately, just finds a, like, you know, finds a steal, dunks. But then, you know, later on in the game, it felt like he kind of tapered off. It was a kind of, I don't know, I guess it's like a bargain you have to make if you're the Clippers. You need Kawhi Leonard going down, you know, the line in the playoffs. You're not going to get very far without him. You're probably not going to get past the Mavericks even. But at the same time, it really messed up their rhythm having him back in the game. So I'm hoping, like, if you're the Clippers, what you have to hope for is that he gets better throughout the series, and that can kind of offset the fact that you lost game two, largely in part to, you know, because your offensive rhythm was just completely messed up. I mean, like, that they were just playing. I think I was listening to Bill and KOC break it down. I think Bill called it the toilet bowl offense, and I think that's kind of exactly what it was. It was just really ugly, and Luka Doncic also played the best defense that I've seen him play in his career. This is a really good matchup for him on that end, because I think he's guarding guys like James Harden, Kawhi Leonard, Paul George, who are a little bit older. And you look at a guy like James, it's like, I don't know, if I'm Luka, I'm like, I'm just guessing, like, okay, what would you do in this situation? Because I'm a lot like you. So I just, yeah, it's a good matchup for him. It's a good matchup for him. There's nobody like that's too quick. He's just big. You know, I saw like Paul George tries to like get an elbow into him and he can't, you know, and same goes for James. Same goes for Kawhi.
Yeah, and that first step, I think that's a great point. That first step isn't quite there just because of where they are in their careers, and it's actually Luka can match them. He might even be a little bit quicker to some of their spots. So that is a fascinating matchup. I do think it is interesting, the Dallas defense. The last 20 games of the season, they were the best defense in the NBA. The Clippers love isolation basketball, that, you know, that offense you were talking about, that Bill was talking about. So we have a lot of isolation offense going against one of the best defenses in the country that has, obviously, rim protection there with Dallas. So I think that matchup is what is interesting in this series. It's isolation ball versus this Dallas defense. Is Dallas' defense good enough to hold up? Because they look like it in game two.
Yeah, I think so. By the way, I love that you call them the best defense in the country. After getting out of March Madness mode, I find myself writing in the nation, in the country a lot more. I'm like, wait, no, it's like we got to toggle back.
To the association, right?
Yeah, I don't know why we do that. I mean, technically, Dallas is the best basketball defense in the country.
Or we say in the world, right? I mean, I think we could go global, right? It's the best in the globe.
I mean, that Team USA runner might have something to say about that. I think so. I mean, I think they've made a lot of improvements or deadline deals to get Daniel Gafford, whose status in this series is going to be a big factor. I think as we're recording, we still don't know if he's going to be available for game three or not. And he hurt his ankle and he didn't return for game two. But this is a Dallas team that also has a lot of options. They ended up finishing with Maxi Kleber, who I think has been the best defender in this series at that five spot in game one and game two. Just his ability to switch. He also spreads the floor on the other end. He makes it a little bit easier on Kyrie and Luka, gives them a little bit more space as well, especially with how good Zubac has been with cleaning up some of like the easy lob looks that Dallas, you know, we got used to them seeing. They had 18 dunks in one game this season against the Hornets. Like, that, we just haven't seen that in this series. So Kleber might be the better option anyways. But yeah, this Dallas team, like, they're incredibly physical. PJ Washington was awesome. Derek Jones was awesome. Kyrie was awesome. Luka was awesome. And I think that's kind of the big question for me with the Clippers. If your supposed weak links for Dallas are going to be okay in this series on defense, then you have to create a lot more advantages with your isolation style. They're obviously going to play a lot of isolation. It's just a way that they play. It just got really bogged down in game two, and I just don't think it can again in game three. You got to get some movement, get some level of advantage. I love when they even, you know, like Norman Powell hasn't been big yet, and I think he's pretty pissed off that he wasn't a Sixth Man of the Year nominee. I think he's going to at some point have a big game here. He's got a lot of experience in big games too. You know, rip him off of screens, get something going that's a little bit faster, especially, you know, when you have a guy like Luka guarding him. I think you can use Paul George in those ways too. And I also think Kawhi Leonard is going to, if he can play, I think he's going to get better as the series goes on. And I think I have so much faith in Kawhi Leonard when he's healthy. He's just one of those guys that, like Luka, he just sets his own pace and he can back down pretty much anybody. So I think, you know, they kind of got their bad Kawhi game out of their system, I think.
Yeah, I think that's a good call. You mentioned the Mavs' depth. I mean, Gafford, I mean, he had, you know, Dwight Powell on the sidelines patting him down like a good teammate, trying to make sure he's okay. PJ Washington hit two big threes, corner threes in that fourth quarter that, I mean, the role players swing these series. And I think PJ Washington stepping up has been a big deal for Dallas. And then you got Lively, who's a rookie. I mean, can you rely on PJ Washington and Lively? Like, is this something where this isn't a one game kind of moment where these guys could actually help them win a series?
I'm a little bit worried about the depth if Daniel Gafford can't come back, just because of, we saw it in game one, the way that Zubac immediately, like, they decided that we're going to run their offense through Ivaka Zubac to start the game, but it worked out because Ty Lue is just, he just understands basketball in ways that you and I and anybody else really doesn't.
He loves matchups. He told me that, he basically said that's all he cares about is like matchups, like a chessboard to him. So I feel like he and Spoelstra both kind of exist in that space where they're like, I don't care about anything else I've seen on tape. I care about what is happening right now in this moment, and I make adjustments accordingly. So it's a good philosophy in the playoffs.
It is a good philosophy in the playoffs. You can see why it's brought him so much success. He's such an interesting coach. Like, mm-hmm. he's just like, he's a total gamer, and he just, like, I don't think he has, like, kids or a wife, and, like, he just, like, was up, like, 2 a.m., 3 a.m., like, he's always
just like
texting
Tibbs.
People on the
Tibbs
Clippers.
Said he married basketball.
He's, like, he's got some Tibbs in him, but except that, like, Ty's also a former player at the same time, and, like, he'll still, like, see these guys out in runs, like, he'll see them in summer. I think he just crosses every box as far as, like, being able to be player-friendly, but also being able to say, hey, like, you're not going to play ever, or you're not going to play in this series, or we're going to bring you off the bench. And he's an awesome coach. But yeah, I think what was your question again?
We're just talking about the series in general, just kind of the depth of the Mavericks. Can they hold up with Lively? Can they hold up with PJ Washington?
Yeah, I worry about it because there's going to be a lot of guys they tried to get fouls in game one. So if you can't have Gafford out there, then, you know, you're going to have to start scraping the bottom of the barrel a little bit there. And I don't love that for the Mavericks.
One last thing on this series. Coach Kidd, Jason Kidd, said, quote, "We played 48 minutes of physical basketball. Both teams were under 100. It was 90s basketball at its best." I ask you a simple question. Did it make you think of 90s basketball?
No.
I don't think so either. I just feel like this is a nostalgia play that we get now. When any game is under 100 points and we don't break Lawler's Law, then everyone says this was a great 90s game. I'm not sure it was like that. I didn't see the one-to-one comparison. But Coach Kidd making it happen. So, one last thing. Thoughts on Kidd. How do you feel about him so far in the series?
I think he's doing a good job. And to his point, you know, I think something that he's talked about, they identified, as everybody else in the league identified, that the refs just are over it. They're not giving some of these calls anymore for plays that I think, you know, basketball fans are just kind of sick of. Like, it's a great time for ethical hoops, I think. Like, I love, you know, I love watching a guy like Luka get an ethical 30 as opposed to, you know, just like, kind of pumps, like, faking his way into oblivion. I will say, in this series, it hasn't quite played out that way. The series itself has been very physical, but the refs have been a little bit more. I think this has been the most liberal whistle I've seen so far in the playoffs. We saw that awful call in game one where James Harden gets three free throws on Kleber, and it's very clearly an offensive foul. There were a lot of ticky-tack things in game two as well. So it's a strange thing, I think, for these teams to have to navigate right now. They don't really know what type of whistle they're getting, which is always true, but there's this extra layer where the refs have basically decided that they're going to swallow it. And I think it makes for really good basketball, but I would call it back to maybe like 2014. I don't think we're going back to the 90s.
I think a decade is a good call. And the ref manipulation, the gaming of the game had gotten a little bit out of control, especially when you have guys like James Harden and Luka Doncic in a series together. So I think the refs are doing the right thing. So shout out to the NBA for making the call upstairs. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk about Ant-Man, the Timberwolves, and the Phoenix Suns. We'll be right back.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Through the Ringer. We're here with Sirit Sohi, and we're talking NBA playoffs. We're talking matchups, and we're talking stars. So I want to start with this series. A lot of star power. The Timberwolves going to Phoenix to take on the Suns. Suns -4 in Game 3. This has been a fascinating watch so far. We've had some nice pass-the-baton moments with Ant-Man and Kevin Durant. So I ask you, Sirit, simple question. Is Ant-Man the best player in this series right now? How do we feel about that?
Yeah, no question. Absolutely, okay. No question. Like, on both ends.
I said, I think it is no question. That's great.
Yeah, I mean, just on both ends of the ball right now, he's just been incredible. It's like the way that he picked apart the Sun scheme in game one, he kind of realized, and it's coming out in the second half, like, oh, they're just going to give me the middle of the floor. I have to basically just dance around, hit some like spinning fadeaways, all that fun stuff. Like, I love Ant in the middle of the floor. I think he's just so creative, the way that he gets to his shots. And then they just open up the floor, and he immediately kind of got off the ball after that. And like, they just start spraying three pointers. Game two, different story. He doesn't quite have as good of a game, but I think, you know, his assists were huge. And he put it best, man. Like, they got KD, we got Jaden McDaniels, man. Like, I don't know what else to say.
I just love that he empowered Jaden McDaniels. There's a lot of people, when Ant said that back in February, that rolled their eyes and they said, what is Anthony Edwards talking about? He was talking about this moment. He was talking about this matchup, and Jaden McDaniels obviously stepped up to the stage. He has an aura about him. I think when people talk about Anthony Edwards, there's just special terms that come out. He has had that in this series so far, but he's going against a team that has three superstars. Let's talk about that side of the coin, because the Phoenix Suns made a lot of decisions that were win-now decisions, right? Kevin Durant, Bradley Beal, Devin Booker, and now we got people talking about, should they bench Bradley Beal? Should they bring in a point guard? I mean, where do we stand with the Phoenix Suns, and what is the future if it doesn't work out and they end up losing this series?
Man, you know what I keep thinking about, and it's not really a fair comparison because it's not a move that they could have necessarily made, but it just shows you how important it is to have role players, and with the way that depth is playing out as a key storyline in this series. Could you imagine if the Suns had Mike Conley instead of, the Timberwolves? I think it would be a completely different story. I mean, I don't know. It's just, this is what was going to happen. Like, the writing was always on the wall. I thought as soon as they made that trade, it was a horrible idea. And I don't think that there was a lot of consideration in terms of, like, looking back in basketball history and seeing what actually wins. I understand, like, the appeal of putting together a bunch of superstars, but at the same time, the superstars that have had success together while they've won have generally either been a bit younger, like Miami and the Big Three, and been able to play two-way basketball, and had a guy like LeBron, which, I mean, you can't really make any comparisons to anybody, like, when you got a guy like LeBron, because he can fill any gap that you ask him to. So when you don't have that depth, it's all right, because he'll go play center. He'll go play point guard. You need 20 rebounds tonight? Sure. You need 14 assists? Sure. The Suns don't have anybody like that. They have Hooper. This is like the most Hooper versus basketball player series of all time. Mm-hmm. Except I think Anthony Edwards might actually be the biggest Hooper in the series. And it's just, you know, like, they don't have, like, Kevin Durant is probably the one guy that could probably do that better than anybody else. But he's also been their most reliable scorer, and he can't do it every night. He's just not that guy anymore. So it never made sense to me. I think that we're also kind of in this stage with transactions where everybody feels like players. You also have an owner like Matt Ishbia, who just wanted to come in, make a splash, not a very patient guy, where you don't have a lot of success, and people just want to make moves right away. And it's like, are those moves actually going to make you better? Or are you just making a move to make a move? Because it feels like that's what the Phoenix Suns did in the offseason. Not only with the Bradley Beal trade, and I understand that KD and Booker wanted that guy out there, but the DeAndre Ayton for Nurkic trade is also a disaster. And I know that he's not always the most reliable guy in the playoffs, but God, like, I'm sure they would love some ball containment right now that didn't, like, make them have to compromise and sell out on the rest of their defense. I think that would be really, really useful in a series like this. So, yeah, for me, it's just like, this was obviously going to happen. And if they lose in embarrassing fashion, which I kind of expect them to, because this is a very physical series, and I don't think that it's going to get any less physical. I just think it's going to wear them down anymore. Then, but it's like, what do you even do? What do you even do? And you also have to ask yourself the question, like, should we do what we did last season, just make a move to make a move? Because I don't think there's a good one out there that actually makes him better right now. Like, Brad Beal has a no trade clause, and beyond that, nobody wants that deal. Like, I don't know what I'm doing 3 years from now, but Bradley Beal is being paid $57 million by the Suns 3 years from now. Like, that is ridiculous, man. So I just think, yeah, I hate what the Suns did. I think they're in a really bad spot. We always knew they were going to be in a really bad spot.
And there's no quick fix, like you said. I mean, it is kind of what it is at this point. And there is a lot of irony to be found with Isaiah Thomas pulling the strings to a team that has no point guard. One of the few guys that has won championships as the point guard and as a small guy. Really a novelty and an anomaly when it comes to the NBA and championships. So, yeah, the Phoenix Suns, they have a lot to figure out. But the Timberwolves, let's talk about them. Let's talk about the positives because they have a lot figured out. The size they haven't figured out. The chemistry. We talked about the aura of Anthony Edwards. One of my favorite videos that I've seen in the playoffs so far was they're shooting around, Futures playing, Luka Garza's guarding him, and then Cat and Luka Garza just start dancing together, you know? You see that, it has like a college vibe to it. This Timberwolves team just feels like they like each other, they play together really well, and they're playing high-level basketball with that size. What are your thoughts on just what you've seen so far from this group?
It reminds me of the team that I watched 2 years ago in the first round that was just so all in on their coach, where you had Patrick Beverley basically, like, you know, doing press conferences with Anthony right. Edwards, just saying, yeah, like, we know he's a dog, and they're all crediting each other. I think a lot of it just, man, you got to give credit to Anthony Edwards. He's just such a good leader, and it's so interesting to me to watch him, you know, simultaneously be the guy that will talk but also can back it up at the same time, but also be the mature sort of voice of reason, like a calming presence on the court, where you still have guys like, you know, Karl Anthony Towns picking up early fouls and still playing with a lot of emotions that he's not always able to control. Just the fact that, like, that Edwards has become the steadying force on that team is so interesting to watch, and it just speaks to his leadership. And yeah, I mean, they have fun, because I think that's a fun thing to watch when a team is really good defensively and they're finding success. I think it just gives you a little extra juice. It gives you a little extra of that, like, camaraderie. Like, we're on a string together. We have to be. It's incredible to watch.
We're going to take one more break. When we come back, we're going to talk about the Bucks without Giannis and where the Pacers stand heading back to Indy. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Through the Ringer. Final series we're going to talk about with Sirit. This is a fascinating one. We got the Bucks and the Pacers. There's been a lot of chirping in this series. There's been a lot of name calling. Bobby Portis called them front runners. Tyrese Halliburton, you know, has chirped back in his own ways. He's changed his voice a couple times. I mean, there's a lot of drama and intrigue, but we also have the cloud of Giannis Antetokounmpo not playing in this series. So we're 1-1, Pacers -5 at home. Siakam had a great game there in game two. What are your thoughts on this series so far, Sirit, and what do we expect to see in game three?
I think Tyrese Halliburton would be a great crooner. I think he should try that out. Like, that would, right, you know, right. is a side hustle maybe after all this is over. His voice. I think I may be in the minority here, but I like a raspy voice. I like that it goes up and down in pitch.
I just like that it drops out sometimes and it picks back up. I mean, I think it's like any actor, you know, any Australian that has to play Americans in movies, you know what I mean? I think it happens with everybody. So I just think it's entertaining. Thank you, Tyrese Halliburton.
Yeah, it's fun. I think this has been an interesting series so far. It's not the most aesthetically pleasing, in my opinion, but I think pace has basically been the biggest story. I think game two, Pacers were just able to run Milwaukee off the floor. And I think that Milwaukee's transition defense needs to get better. But beyond that, I just think that Milwaukee needs to execute their offense better so that the Pacers can't really get off in transition, because unless Giannis makes it back, they just can't really, they're not going to be able to guard this team in transition. They did become a much better transition defense team under Doc. That's probably the biggest change that we've seen that's been in a positive sense since Doc took over. But man, like, you don't have the head of the snake there with Giannis. So yeah, I think they need to change the complexion of the way that this series is played. And it's all just really going to come down to that. It's going to be a clash of style. If the Pacers can play their style, especially going back home, I think they're going to run them out of the gym.
Yeah, and how do we get into a pace of play kind of battle, and how does it start for the team that wants to play fast? Miss shots, and I feel like when the Bucks miss shots and they get out on the break, it's over with. So the way to, you know, kind of cope and figure that out is to make shots, and one of those guys that they need to make shots is Dame Lillard. What are your thoughts so far? I mean, obviously a great first half in game one, one of those, okay, that's right, Dame is here, but since then has struggled to kind of find his footing. He's had moments, obviously, but what are your thoughts on Dame so far in this series?
Well, it's just his age now at this point, right? Like, he's not going to be able to do it every single night. That's it just comes down to that, really. Like, Dame time is just, you know, it's going to be temporary, right? Like, you're not going to get it all the time. So you need other guys to contribute. I think Chris Middleton, Brooke Lopez, those guys need to contribute a little bit better. But beyond that, honestly, it's just like Milwaukee's lack of depth after those guys is really concerning to me as well. Like, that's, even when those guys show up, if you don't have Giannis, and everything else just becomes a lot more glaring. Like, you just start really looking at the Pat Connaughtons of the world and being like, what are you actually doing here, my guy? So yeah, it's just Dame is just, he's not going to be able to do it all the time. So they need, and unless Giannis can come back, they just need it from somewhere else, and they need to hit their threes.
Yeah, they need to make some threes for sure. I mean, maybe a guy like Andre Jackson gets some more playing time. I feel like they got to dig into that bench. But when Doc Rivers sees your birth certificate, that is usually a death sentence. Because if it's under 25, you are not going to get off the bench in a playoff series, unfortunately. Can the Bucks win without Giannis? I think that's the simple question. And I think that's like the question that everybody has in the back of their minds.
No, I don't think so.
I don't think so either.
Come back at some point this series, and I don't think. I mean, frankly, it's a calf strain. I don't think he can come back unless he's actually better. We saw what happened with Kevin Durant in the 2019 Finals when he came back too early and he tore his Achilles. You just can't risk that if you're Giannis. I think you kind of need to just. Yeah, I think if you're Milwaukee, you got to just take a step back and say, hey, we've had a really weird season. We had a midseason coaching change that ended up being a disaster. Our offseason acquisition is having a really hard season on and off the court. And now our best player is hurt at the worst time. Sometimes you just got to accept that it's not the year. I understand that there's a lot of pressure, but at the same time, that doesn't change the fact that things are just not really going their way. So unless he's legitimately healthy, he shouldn't play. And if he can't play, I don't think that he can really, like, it's like the biggest question to me is who guards Siakam going down the line for the rest of the series. I think Brook Lopez can actually do a pretty good job when he's locked in. I think Milwaukee kind of just didn't show up in a lot of ways in game two. So that would be a great adjustment for them. Just remember that it's a playoff game.
Show up.
Yeah, that's like always. Yeah, like that should be number one on the list. But he should probably be the guy on him, right? And Yeah, that's kind of gets to another point, too, where it's like, okay, do you want to then bring him back and have him immediately go and guard the guy that's been giving you 30 pieces back to back? I don't know if that's necessarily the way to go either.
Yeah, I just feel like my only concern, obviously, is the injury for Giannis. Like, if you rush him back and there's something more serious, I think that's everybody's concern. So do you just play cautious? But when you're the Bucks and you're doing the calculus of windows, right? We always talk about championship windows. If you do the calculus, you see the Celtics lose that game, too. They're not the juggernaut that you maybe thought they were. The East is a little bit more open than maybe even you thought. Doc Rivers is a championship-winning head coach, and he has done it before. Is there any sort of calculus from the top where they're like, can we try to see if Giannis can run up and down the court 94 feet and just get a temperature check? Because I feel like, unfortunately, that's how ownership works sometimes with these NBA teams. Like, they see the opening, and then they say, well, let's get a check here. Maybe not as cautious as we once were. Is there any of that that could happen with Giannis?
I think Giannis is going to be the one who decides that. And I think Giannis is probably thinking all those things. Like, we know what he's like. He's going to try to play. And he has been historically a guy who has played through injuries. That's kind of part of the reason we're here right now. And he has, I mean, you can take it back to the finals, right? Like, he had a knee injury that looked terrifying and then just came back, you know, dropped 50 in game six. Had like one of the most incredible finals performances of all time. So I don't think that it really has to be pressure from the ownership group or anybody else. I think if anything, they need to be thinking, okay, we just extended this guy. Maybe we need to save him from himself a little bit. Yeah. As long as Giannis has the understanding of, okay, things didn't go our way this season. this front office kind of did everything I asked them to do. They went and got Adrian Griffin instead of Nick Nurse because I rubbed shoulders the wrong way with Nick Nurse, who would have been a great coach for this team. Then they went and got Damian Lillard. Then when I didn't like Adrian Griffin, then they went and got Doc Rivers. Maybe, you know, things just don't work out sometimes, and I don't necessarily go and like go off and run to the next franchise that looks like the hottest thing. And, you know, to his credit, I don't necessarily think Giannis is that type of guy. I think that he obviously applied pressure this summer, as any superstar should. I think Dave would tell you that, you know, applying pressure when you actually have some power is really smart. He probably wishes that he did that when he was in Portland. But yeah, I think Giannis is a guy who's going to do that. But he's also like, this is just not the time in his career to do that. And he's, when you look at how he plays, like if he loses his athleticism, if he actually gets hurt as a serious injury, I'm looking at his comeback differently than what I'd look at with Kevin Durant. Like if there's any player who I think can afford to do something like that and is in that type of situation, it's probably Kawhi Leonard. He's already extended. And with the Clippers, this is the window. It's this year and if it doesn't go well, it's nothing. With Giannis, I just think as long as he is in his prime and he is healthy, we just saw him have an incredible season. You're always going to be in the hunt. You just have to retool. But you don't want to go and take a risk that, you know, just jeopardizes Giannis himself.
Yeah, I think that's patience is obviously the call there. And I think that's a great point about Giannis. This is a guy that in game three of the finals, they had to take him out because he couldn't catch his breath. That's how excited and hyped up he was. And I mean, I'll always remember that Jrue Holiday and Chris Middleton press conference. They were down 0-2 in the finals and they were laughing and yucking it up with each other. And all these people were upset. They don't seem like they care. And then they ripped off four straight wins with Giannis. So the Bucks have been down before and they've been able to bounce back. But obviously, it's a lot better when you have number 34 next to you. One last thing on this series here. Let's look at the coaches. Doc Rivers, Rick Carlisle, two championship coaches going head to head. Who has the edge right now? And what have you seen from both coaches that kind of stands out, if anything?
Oh, that's an interesting question. You know, I don't think coaching has been coaching is obviously a huge factor. I just don't think it's the biggest storyline to me because I think that, you know, in game one, I didn't love Rick Carlisle going 11 deep. That wasn't necessarily the move. I didn't love the coverage on Damian Lillard, and I think that they adjusted both those things well in game two. But I think, man, like game one, Milwaukee showed up. They won. Game two, Indiana showed up. Milwaukee didn't. Indiana won. Like it's a series that has really come down to more execution of what's being asked and the X's and O's to me. I don't think, you know, I think with the Siakam defense, it's really just about effort. I think Lopez has historically been a pretty good Siakam defender. I think he's your best option if you don't have Giannis. And, you know, when it comes to transition defense, it's like, yeah, make your shots or run back. You know, it's one of those two things. Right. And it came down to execution to me, if like more than anything else.
Right. And if you expect you're going to start missing shots, maybe just everybody commit to getting back because you know you're going to miss. Maybe that's a big fix there for Doc Rivers. Sierra, you're the best. We appreciate you coming on the show as always. And where can we find all your work? And then we'll let you go enjoy your Friday.
Thank you. Appreciate that. I'll be writing off of a lot of these games. Right. I just wrote something off. I was at that game, too. I didn't see you at game two.
No, I'm in 210, you know what I mean? I'm just hiding away. I wasn't there as a press.
Do you get the press credential and just disappear?
I was just there with tickets. I just, you know, observing.
Wow, I love it. True fan.
Yeah,
true
yeah, yeah. Just got to sit next to all the Mavericks fans in the building.